I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. This is the time of year that normally we talk about underreported stories. We'll also talk later on about predictions for the following year. What, in your mind, Austin, is the most underreported story or story that hasn't broken into the consciousness of Western thought?
Oh, Dan, there are a bunch out there because, and again, when we're framing this question, we realize that there are all kinds of reporting sources that people may read. And, of course, Strategy Page readers and Strategy Talk listeners are have a, I think, a broader feel for things going on in some of the forgotten places on the planet or the hard corners. But, yeah, I think it does get coverage. It's South China Sea, which gets plenty of coverage because it's China, and you have the U.S. Navy on a freedom of navigation operation, or Navy patrol planes and the Chinese screaming at them and the like. But the Philippines and the way the Philippines has slowly. On the military and diplomatic level, begun to grapple with the threat posed by China. And I'm going to put a little caveat on my own statement there, realizing that the Filipinos in the early 1990s were already complaining about Chinese intrusions in the middle of the South China Sea, Spratlys and some of the outer areas that Filipinos claimed, and the Filipinos also, and you'll see this cropping up over the now the last I'm talking about a 20 year period since 1995, were putting small garrisons out on some of these the larger islets, and in some cases there was I'm trying to remember what kind of ship it is. I was about to say it was an LST, but
it was an LST.
Thank you, Jim. There we go. That they essentially ran aground on one of the atolls and used it as a garrison platform. They were doing these things, but they were certainly very, very small scale. The Filipinos were also caught in their own diplomatic battle with the United States. Goodbye, bye-bye, imperialist U.S. Get out of Subic Bay. Get out of Clark Field. So that huge Subic Bay complex the U.S. Navy had, which was a major employer in the area. And the Filipinos had the jobs. They had the skills for doing the high-level work on U.S. warships. We left. The imperialist was gone. Well, what that meant was the ally that you need against a large expanding regional power, China, was maybe still there emotionally, diplomatically, and morally, but wasn't there militarily. And we can see this really 3 years ago when the Filipinos started formulating what was really a rearmament plan. I think it was promulgated actually in 2013, but it was supposed to be kicking off late last year, early this year. They may not have the money for it, but they know that they have the need for it, and it's a wide range of weapon systems, naval upgrade. They realize they're not going to be able to handle larger, expensive platforms, but they're looking for their own version of flipping it back on the Chinese area denial. With the same kind of missiles, anti-ship missiles, anti-aircraft missiles, light forces. And they're also in the throes of admitting that that was a mistake to say goodbye to the U.S. Navy. They haven't, last I read, ratified this new bilateral defense agreement. Understand that we still maintained a bilateral defense agreement, but this is one with some real teeth to it. So I don't think this has gotten as much coverage as other as much coverage as it deserves. Interestingly enough, the Philippines are also in a quasi-alliance with the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese find it's easier to get along with them, even though the Vietnamese, you know, are saying we want a relationship with the United States because of the Chinese threat. The Vietnamese still have a let's go it alone or on our own defense preference. But it's easier for them to quasi-cooperate with the Filipinos. I don't think that gets a lot of coverage. The other thing too, and I'll let Jim comment on this. I think the Filipinos have made some real real progress against the Islamist extremists operating in the southern and southwestern islands. Abu Sayyaf has been managed a couple of name attacks in the last year, but they've been pretty effective in putting it down and keeping it down. So that's when you just ask me off the top of my head, I think that's one of the stories. That's underreported in some ways.
Jim, what comes to the top of your mind?
Well, I think that the big one that we've actually been covering, but not many other people are, is the inherent problem with Islam and Islamic terrorism. This is something that, for being politically correct or whatever, the West doesn't really want to cover. Now, ironically, it's covered within Islam, more frankly, as it were, the Arab Reform Movement, which is sponsored by Saudi Arabia, of all people. And the problem is, and it's quite visible. I mean, there's plenty of evidence in the West and this first came out visibly, any historian knows it exists, but it came out visibly when they started doing opinion series of Muslims in Europe back, I think as far back as the 1990s, but especially after 2001. And they found out that, good news was most Muslims opposed Islamic terrorism, the ones in Europe. But there was a significant percentage. This scared the crap out of the Germans because they made a big deal out of it. That 10%, you know, agreed that, you know, Islamic terrorism was justified, you know, in defense of Islam. Now, that's something Westerners can't understand. Who's attacking them? Of course, to many Muslims, the West is attacking. But what further terrified the Germans was, you know, 1 or 2% justified any Islamic terrorism. Because, and this is the kicker that nobody, you know, the elephant in the room nobody wants to acknowledge exists, is that Islam, among the major religions, is the only one that was founded in violence. In other words, from the very beginning, violence was used to spread the faith, not, you know, conversions, persuasion, but basically convert or die. The problem with that is that the Islamic scriptures are full of this. Now, you know, more moderate Muslims will point out that there's plenty of other things in the scripture that mitigate against this, but unfortunately, those key elements are there. They're very explicit. And not only do they mention, you know, justify militant Islam, but they also basically justify hatred, you know, violence against non-Muslims. And this is something that's always been there. It couldn't be acted on for many centuries because one of the other problems Islam has, again, which doesn't get mentioned much, although it's a historical fact, is that, you know, like Muslims like to talk about, hey, they're the ones who brought, you know, a lot of the wisdom of the ancients, you know, and scientific breakthroughs. Yeah, the problem is that all basically ended 1,000 years ago. And the reason they don't like to talk about it is the reason it ended was because there was that struggle that continues in Islam between the conservatives and the non-conservatives. Non-conservatives are the majority, but the conservatives had the scripture on their side, and they could basically get away with threatening violence to anyone who basically got too much into this modern stuff. And that, like, that started with like the Renaissance and all that modern technology. I mean, a semi-funny, as it were, tragic comic example of that was Abdulaziz. He's the guy who founded Saudi Arabia in the 1920s. He struggled against this, sometimes violently, but usually with a little more, you know, subtlety. At one point, he wanted to introduce radio into the Saudi Arabian kingdom. And he promptly got a lot of opposition from these conservatives, who were very strong in Saudi Arabia, still are. And he found, again, he could have ordered them, killed some, et cetera, et cetera. But no, he's admired to this day for being a more subtle guy. And what he did was he had a radio set up in his place where he was holding this talk, this Najlis, whatever, with the conservatives. And he told the people on the other end to, when he got the signal, to start reading the Quran over the radio. And then they started doing that. And the king pointed to this. He says, is this un-Islamic? And they were basically beat. I mean, some of them still believed, it's even more of a sacrilege, but they were basically outnumbered and they kept shut up. The Saudi Arabians are the source of most of the Islamic terrorism because they after the 1979 incident, when the local Islamic radicals invaded the most holy places, the Kaaba in Mecca, and the Saudis had the call, and they don't like to admit this, foreigners, to help clean them out quickly without turning it into a long siege and gun battle. After that, the king, again, Abdulaziz was gone, was one of the sons, basically worked out a compromise with the conservatives, gave them control of the education system. And in return, they would basically, you know, keep Islamic, you know, violence down inside, but not outside. And of course, 1980, when Saudi Arabia was supporting the holy warriors, the Afghans, in fighting the Russians, billions of dollars were spent, a lot of it on weapons, and they were the major supplier of weapons to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, but also to Wahhabi, that's the very conservative sect that's dominant in Saudi Arabia, missionaries, and building religious schools, madrasas, and this was the source of the Taliban and many of the Islamic terrorists who now are the curse of Pakistan. So this is a dirty little secret of Islam, which is at the root, as it were, of all Islamic terrorism. And nobody wants to report on it, except inside, you know, Arabia, where there's a lot of interesting, you know, stories being published. Very few of them are translated into English, at least not officially. But those that are telling, because they basically, you know, discuss what I'm discussing now, what we discuss in Strategy Page quite frequently, but the mass media will not touch it at all.
Austin, what comes second to your mind?
We cover this one, but this is one that I just don't see a lot of outside of the certain niches in the major media, and that is the way Mexican cartels have spread their operations internationally, supplanted the Colombians. I mean, this is old news to some degree, but now definitely supplanted Colombian cartels in handling drugs moving out of South America into North America to Asia and Europe. I mean, and also moved into other businesses to include minerals, shipping minerals to China in a lot of cases, and also handling trade, some of it quote-unquote legitimate trade, the same way the old mafia moved into illegitimate businesses here in the United States after getting its grub stake from Prohibition and the other criminal activities, moving into quote-unquote trucking operations and port operations and seaports and the like. We covered this heavily really from 2013 on into early this year in the Mexico section, but it's worth pointing out that the Mexican Navy took over control of a couple of seaports on Pacific seaports, specifically Lázaro Cárdenas, the major port, and because cartels had really come to dominate operations at the ports, and including again shipping minerals to East Asia, and they took control of several ships at that time that were already loaded with ore and large stockpiles of ore, because in one of the cases of one of the large stockpiles, and I'm doing this from memory, but I remember the report and what we did with it on strategy page, a huge stockpile that the federal prosecutor who was in charge of the operation said it was owned really by the Knights Templar cartel. Now, again, we're relying on some other, you know, reporting sources for this, but the various cartels, Sinaloa, so-called representatives of Knights Templar, they weren't directly pinned as being with the Knights Templar cartel, and then one cartel-like group that has operated as something of a negotiating go-between for other cartels in Mexico, had operations or people that were connected to them in the Philippines, in China, and elsewhere, quote-unquote, through Southeast Asia and Asia. And again, some of that had to do with what they were doing was two-way trade going back to Mexican seaports. And again, even though some of this was out of media reports, most of this information was ultimately given out by Mexican federal prosecutors, and you can see why the Navy took some of the was the force to take some of the action that that it did to shut down the cartel operations. Jim has touched on this when writing about Colombia, and I've certainly handled it when we're writing about Mexico, but about the Mexican cartels essentially buying out some of the Colombian operations. And then what they have done, this is old news to strategy page readers. It's actually old news to folks who go and read the annual Drug Enforcement Administration reports on narcotics trafficking organizations or drug trafficking organizations. The use of interstate, north-south interstate and east-west interstate corridors by cartels for drug distribution operations here in the United States. Again, it models in some cases American trucking companies, and I'm sure that's what they took their lead on, or that or common sense. You go up I-35 because that will connect you from Laredo ultimately to near the Canadian border, And if you have an operation along I-40, you are not quite coast to coast, but you're close to coast, the same kind of distribution network. And this does crop up in regional and local newspapers here in the United States, and occasionally national newspapers, when they talk about how local gangs have ties to Mexican cartels. Well, they're like local distributors for the larger organization. So, again, Dan, is it underreported? I think the larger story about how well thought out some of the operations are by the cartels themselves is not reported. The local discreet operation by the local gangs, they do get reported. And there's another story that relating to Mexico that doesn't get much focus nationally here in the United States, and that is the real problem that Enrique Peña Nieto's himself and his administration face now with the disgust, and I don't know if it's a majority, it may be, it's a huge plurality of Mexican citizenry that are just disgusted with what they see as the, if not total corruption by government functionaries. They don't believe that the government is totally corrupt. But the attitude, the word that they use is impunity, that these cartel leaders can function at least in semi-open operations without with some degree of safety. The Guzman escape from a high security prison was another example of this. That Shorty Guzman, Joaquin Guzman's escape in July of this year was a huge political blow to President Peña. He couldn't keep the head of the Sinaloa cartel in jail, and he escapes through a mile-long tunnel underneath the prison. And the Iguala massacre of September of last year, which is still quote unquote not totally resolved, who did it and why. There are plenty of people in Mexico say they have good reason to believe that the authorities did not act in time to try to stop the murders, and then in the first month after the massacre, covered up for mayor and the mayor's wife, the local police there in Iguala, and it also implicated the governor of Guerrero State. And the governor of Guerrero State, same party as President Peña, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI. I don't think this gets a lot of coverage, and it leads to what you have in Mexico City right now is a very damaged federal government that has a significant portion of the population that is not just distrusted, but is disgusted with it. And it's still an absolutely important American ally, and it's our border nation. I don't know that story gets kind of coverage it deserves. How about that? Oh, well, I hear I've talked about drugs, and then finally the other, but it's a lot of it relates to the issue of endemic corruption. And go Google impunity Mexico. You'll see that there's lots of action on that line by people who are and organizations who are fed up with it.
Jim, the second thing that comes to your mind?
Well, I think there's we've mentioned this before. Many of the wars in Africa don't get covered. These are fairly substantial conflicts. Somalia still going on. There were, nearly 4,000 people died last year. Not just the Boko Haram, which has created, which is neck and neck with, Islamic State, ISIL, in terms of annual deaths, in Nigeria. But there's another problem in Nigeria, which is partly religion related. It's what they call, communal conflicts. This is mostly in central, Nigeria, where the Christian half of the population, which is mostly in the south, and the Muslim half of the population, which is mostly in the north, where the line is. And, it's the Muslims are primarily herding, communities, herders, and the Christians are largely farmers. That sounds like a conflict we used to have in the American West, or maybe still do to some extent. But it's been brought under control to a certain extent. I mean, there are only about, fewer than 1,000 deaths last year, but the last few years it's been a couple of thousand, a year. And I think a lot of the religious fanatics there have gone off north to join Boko Haram, which for a while until earlier this year seemed to be on a roll. Now they're on the defensive, but they're still there. They're still big, and they get hardly any media coverage whatsoever.
Dan, let me pick that up. We do try to cover sub-Saharan Africa. On strategy page, as Jim says, these are large conflicts. They are underreported. I was about to say that I think some of the reason for this even may not just because we are interested in it, and as you know and Jim knows, maybe some folks out there in the audience do. I'm very interested in sub-Saharan Africa for a number of reasons, and have been for a long time. But the first edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War was looked at. It was then called Zaire, and Zaire's perpetual crises, and it is in perpetual crises. If you start going across, and we won't even deal quite with the Sahel. We'll just let the Sahel cook and say Sudan is in the Sahel, and you could argue that South Sudan is as well, even though there's a huge civil war going on there. And Jim's already mentioned Somalia. There's still low-grade war going on in Ethiopia's Ogaden, some of it tied to Somalia. Central African Republic, the north is Sahel, but then the south and it's southeast, or you're now in Central Africa and the jungle. Still crisis going on there between the Anabalaka militias and the old Salaka and the Salaka movement. Jim's talked about what's going on in Nigeria. There's still instability in Senegal and Gambia. Instability means occasional bouts of shooting and terror. Mali's definitely in the Sahel / Sahara. We cover that. But you go down and Burundi is on the verge of a civil war, if it's not already in a civil war. The Katanga province in Congo is having its own internal civil war. Congo could re-erupt because it looks like Joseph Kabila and his regime he's going to try for a third term, which will just rip Congo, could rip, I think it will rip Congo, Congo apart. And there's tens of millions of people will be involved. Tens of millions of people are already involved in that string of conflicts that I just, sketched. And, gets very little international attention, even though right now, this week, Burundi is, because the African Union is putting together a peacekeeping force. I remember this, 4 years ago, Burundi was a UN peacekeeping success. And then the third term disease is what spun off this latest bout the president succeeded in getting a third term, and he had to really it completely undermined what was the Arusha Agreement. I think that's the name of it, that it stabilized Burundi. So president for life, even by election.
Right.
That's what's going on with that.
Jim, now one of the things that you do that we actually, you do a war update every once in a while where you'll go through and just list all the crap that's going on around the world.
Every 6 months.
That is, that is just chock full of stuff that's underreported.
Yeah, well, strategy page in general covers a lot, if not most, of these underreported wars. Indeed, a lot of the feedback we get from our users, points that out, that, if you want to find out, the other wars, go to strategy page, because you don't find much about it, in terms of analysis anyway, anywhere else. I mean, you can Google some of these places and you'll get little bits and pieces, but we're strategy page, so we give you the big picture.
Right. So, one of the things I want to point out to our listeners is that, we do this on the Strategy Talk, but you can go pull that up every 6 months and take a look at it, and you'll realize that things are maybe not as good as sometimes Western administrations let to be. But
yeah, when politicians say there's peace, that means there's nothing being reported in the mass media that will cause them any discomfort.
Right. Well, it's about time to wrap it up, and it's been a good chat, and I look forward to in 2 weeks talking to both of you about what's going to happen in 2016.
All right, take care.
All right.
Bye. Bye-bye.